and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ed Ochester. Ed Ochester is the author of Sugar Run Road, published by Autumn House Press in 2015. He's the editor of the Pitt Poetry Series and is a member of the core faculty of the Bennington MFA Writing Seminars. He has also published 7 other books of poems as well as 8 limited editions, and has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, the George Garrett Award from the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, and the Artist of the Year Award from the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust. Recent poems have appeared in American Poetry Review, Barrow Street, Agni, Boulevard, Nerf Cowboy, Great River Review, Gettysburg Review, and other magazines. Poems of his were selected for Best American Poems 2007 and 2013. Hi, Ed. How are you?
Okay. Hi.
Hi. We're really happy to have you back. It's been a little while, and you've been writing lots of poems. So I guess you're going to start with something from Sugar Run Road.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to read a few poems from those over the course of today. This is a poem called Letter to Edward Field. Ed Field is a poet who's meant a great deal to me, particularly when I was younger. I never told you that when I was a grad student at Harvard nearly 40 years ago, I sat all afternoon one day in Lamont Library trying to write a paper on the Great Chain of Being for Herschel Baker's course on the Renaissance, and that, out of sheer boredom, I picked up the Hudson Review and opened it at random to a review of your stand-up friend with me, which the critic said was a disgrace to poetry and to the Lamont Prize, which it had won, and quoted The Charmed Pool and some others, poems so funny and sad and true that I collected my notes on Elizabethan world order and ran to the coop to get your book, which metaphorically and just possibly literally saved my life. Let me read a poem that is for someone I met much later. He's a poet in our poetry series, Ross Gay, who's been getting lots of prizes lately and writes wonderful poems. Ross Gay sent an email to Ross Gay. Congratulations on the Times review of Bringing the Shovel Down. Though even in a good review of poetry, there's almost always a snotty little quibble, unless the poet's dead or English. This reviewer hates shimmering labia. Yeah, said Ross. I laughed about that too. Maybe it started when the horde of theory PhDs rose over the horizon and poisoned all the books they landed on. Luckily, then, they started to kill each other off. We can use split infinitives now. But around that time, American poets began to write about John Clare, the mad, sweet nature poet lost in an unjust world. One of the theory people I worked with wrote a novel, unpublished, so bad, cats and dogs might double over, which deepened her hatred of her irrational colleagues publishing poetry and fiction. Perhaps Yogi Berra explained it best. Note that Yogi, like the poet we call Homer, is growing by incremental repetition and now has an enormous oeuvre. Yogi said, in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice, there is.
Nice poem. You know, I wanted to ask you about, you know, there's so much to ask you, but I wanted to ask you about community because it means so much to have someone like you who's done so much and written so many books and had so much success talk about someone like Edward Field who's influenced him. And, you know, it's just inspiring in that way. Can you talk about, I don't know if you want to share this, but people who really influenced you along the way as a really young poet.
Well, the person who influenced me most was, I should back up on that, I think, and say that the young poets who influenced me, you know, very much, was a person named Victor Kentosky, who was a graduate student with me at Wisconsin, and who never published a great deal. He was a teacher for many years at the University of Kansas, but wrote absolutely marvelous little poems. They were contemporary in language. They were often extremely witty. There was absolutely no nonsense about them. He had a poem, for example, which I can quote more or less from memory, which runs in its entirety, "The mailman has left me nothing for weeks, trying to make me believe my friends have forgotten me." You think about that. It's just absolutely wonderful in the story that it suggests. Vic was a person who introduced me to a lot of contemporary poets when I was young and at graduate school at Wisconsin. And many of the people I read from his suggestions mattered a great deal. So he, of all the people I've known, although there are a lot of them, he probably is the single one person who was most influential on me as a young person.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. I haven't heard that story. And, you know, I think about the risks that you take in your poems and the, especially with some overtly political poems that you write. And I wanted to ask you about whether you've always had that courage to do that or if that's something you grew into as a writer, because, you know, there are a lot of poets who, as you know, who don't take any risks in their writing.
You know, what I would say is the second most influential person on me when I was young is a guy named Morris Edelson, who wrote some poems, but he never published much. But he ran a magazine and a press in Madison, Wisconsin, when I was a graduate student there. And Morris, at the least, was what you might call a democratic socialist, a little bit more than that at the time. And he ran a magazine called Quixote, which published my first couple of chapbooks, and which did actually quite well in the Midwest, but also published all sorts of material that had an edge to it, lots of political poems. He published a number of poems of Ginsberg, which were at the time politically inflammatory. Lots of younger people in the Madison culture who were writing about politics. And for much of the time that I was there, I was learning more and more about the conditions of people, myself, in the United States, and essentially moving left, and the influence of my peers around Quixote magazine and Morris Edelson and publishing material made me think that this is what I wanted to do. I didn't want to write according to anybody else's notion of what was the proper way to do it. I wanted as much as possible to write to speak about what I believed and what I saw. And I've been doing that more or less ever since.
Yeah.
Sometimes better than others, but nevertheless, no. Doing it.
Yeah, you have. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. This is called New Year. After calling our son and daughter to wish them happy and good luck, we get to bed early, but get a phone call from my mother, who died in April. She doesn't say where she's calling from, though I can hear laughter in the background. And she says Uncle Frank is making his famous Manhattans, which are, she adds gratuitously, as always, a lot better than I was ever able to make. One of his really puts you to sleep. And I have to reply, Mom, do you know that you never once, so far as I can remember, have told me I love you? And she says rather sadly, "You've always been somewhat of a fool. Don't you remember how that time you passed out at my birthday party? One of your cousins told you later, I cried out, my son, my only son." Let me try another one. These are not too political. This is ancient music. Driving out of Pittsburgh, Brandenburg number 6 on FM, Bach sent it to the Margrave with his job application that was turned down. The music lost for 100 years. So much sweetness hidden. I heard it first at 18 in the Cornell Music Room. I never listened much to classical. And now scribbling this on the porch that overlooks the meadow, Verl mowed for hay before his early death, crushed by machine. I watch the hills rising, wooded, and beyond them, mountain upon mountain, and miles and years away the ocean, below the surf, anemones and whelks, hidden, waving. On the shores of darkness, there is light. Okay. This is one I had been, for this book, writing a number of poems to individual people, usually writers. This is one to my friend Michael Waters. The Pennsylvania Lottery website is down, so I don't know whether I've won 76 million, half of which I promise I'll devote to the poor. So while I'm waiting, I read selected poems which Mike Waters sent me, and love the Gaga new love poems for his wife, Michaela, and reread the poems from his early books. The first was Fishlight from Ithaca House, the press started by my old teacher, Shy Baxter Hathaway. Wonderful, the odd connections in our lives. So this morning, when all the news is about the debt ceiling and right-wing lies that the country's gone bankrupt, and the antics of the latest teen heartthrob disposable booby, Justin Bieber, there's Michael's old poem to an Indian, last seen floating down the Mississippi.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ed Ochester. He's reading some poems from his new book, Sugar Run Road. Ed, Well, the Pitt Poetry Series just turned 50 years old, and I just want to thank you for all that, those many years. I know you weren't there 50 years, but...
Not quite, but 37, I think it is.
But, you know, the Pitt Press, the Pitt Poetry Series was the first poetry series that included women writers, writers of color, gay writers, and I know that was... That was your decision.
Yeah.
Can you talk about if you encountered resistance in pushing that through, and because it changed the landscape of poetry in America?
No. One of the things that was great about the University of Pittsburgh when I first went there is that our director, Fred Hetzel, claimed to know nothing about poetry and claimed that he didn't want to know anything about poetry. And so he let me do whatever the hell I wanted. The only thing he said is, if you have anything that's going to cause a disturbance, please let me know in advance. But other than that, I was free to do what I wanted to do. And I told Fred from the beginning what I wanted to do, as other poetry series were not. We're bringing in more racial minorities, more women, and I'm very proud of the fact we were the first series. We may still be one of the only whose authors are composed at least a half of women. When Harcourt Brace turned down Etheridge Knight's publication, and Eth, who made his living from doing readings and selling his books, had no books to sell. I knew him, and I offered to do a reprint of The Selected, and we finally did that. It took Harcourt Brace about 3 years to agree to let the poems go, even though they weren't going to reprint, but we did that. And the fact that we published one of the greatest black poets of the 20th century has helped us recruit a number of other people who are doing very well and are wonderful writers. So we're right now about where I had hoped that we would be. You know, we have lots of different styles, lots of different kinds of voices. Certainly, many of the books that we publish are not in any sense political in a narrow definition of that word, but it's a glorious bunch of people, a lot of voices doing many different things, and it's something I'm extremely pleased with and happy about. And more, it's one of the things that's most important in my life.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's such an amazing thing that you've accomplished. It's just really, really great. And I never heard that story about Etheridge Knight either. So, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
I'm teaching his book right now. I mean that's such an important book.
No, it really was amazing. You know, that wasn't all that long ago. It was back in the late 20th century. But Etheridge, like a lot of writers of color who were very talented, had a difficult time in placing books. They had a difficult time keeping them in print. I don't know what Eth's sales were at Harcourt Brace, but I know that many years after his death, we're still selling close to 1,000 books of his a year, which is amazing, and which means that he's endured much longer than most writers do. Many of people who might be his children or grandchildren tell me, and I've observed in other contexts too, that he's one of the people who's mattered most to them.
That's
so
right.
Those kinds of choices were not exactly fortuitous. I mean, I wanted to do that kind of thing. And along the way, we made some people happy with it, I think.
That's right. Okay, could you read some more?
Yeah. Okay, here's a couple of poems from the middle of the book. Meyer Country Motel. Meyer Country Motel is in eastern Pennsylvania. I stay there when I'm driving to and from Bennington. Meyer Country Motel. Gunshots at 8 a.m. Oh, just pre-July 4th. Rural Pennsylvanians clinging to their guns. How they hate Obama for that remark. They cling to their churches, too, but guns come first. Well, on to breakfast at the Milford Diner, where the fat Greek owner loves to chat up customers, while the waiter in old tux with string tie and the waitresses who call you honey and two Latin busboys do all the work. Who wants to work hard? We want to be the happy fat owner gabbing. Luckily, the Gideon Bible has some blank pages at the back, so I can write this down before I go. Hambone. Stephen Gall tells me when I'm researching the lives of blues players that hambone is barrel house blues slang for penis and is also used as a verb. Aaron Copland is at least as important to classical music as Hambone Willie Newburn is to the blues. And I remember one March some years ago, sitting in a cabin at McDowell at the piano where Copland had hamboned Appalachian Spring and was very pleased to be in his spectral presence as I one-fingered Yankee Doodle on the Baby Grand and a New England blizzard was dropping 2 feet of snow, while out of loneliness and creative impotence, I wondered how I was ever going to get a poem out of this. Okay. Sunflowers. The ornamental sunflowers aren't turning to face the sun as they're supposed to, but Brits just seen, first time ever, a yellow-throated warbler. Yesterday, when Judith and I were talking about how to reduce our workloads, I saw a headline in the Times, 60 more Iraqis killed by bomb blasts. What's that now? 150,000 civilians? More than Hussein would have, could have. Strange contrast. You don't know where you will be, but you'd better see where you are.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Ed Ochester, reading from Sugar Run Road. Ed, you've written a lot of books over time, and yet there's still humor and tenderness in your work. I know there's some political critique also, but I wanted to ask you, how do you maintain that kind of tenderness and love for humanity, like, over time in your work? And because I think you've seen another poet's work, that humanity doesn't always show up.
I don't know what to say. I think that's a part of me. I think I'm not necessarily a fine chap, and I'm probably much finer in my impulses and poems than I am in my own life, in my life outside of the poems. But I think one of the things that's always been, ever since I've been a kid, and probably has something to do with the way I was treated as a kid, but I've always had some kind of interest in a notion of justice, fair treatment for people. And I've never seen why that shouldn't be reflected in the poems that I write. I try not to walk around being a goody-good and talking to people, you know, and telling them how they ought to think. But I have very clear ideas of how people ought to behave. And it's not that I do it constantly, but often those things will appear in poems. And there often are moments in the news where it's almost irresistible, you know, to write about a political event or so. I just invented, I don't have a copy with me, but I'll tease anyone who may be interested by saying I've just invented a new form called the Trumpina, which I will read in some local events coming up, and I hope that people will copy the form. It's a very intricate form, but it has a refrain, Mr. Trump is a very bad man.
So, a Trumpina?
A Trumpina, yeah. Okay. It's like a sestina, but not quite as long.
Oh. Well, I wish you would have brought one with you.
Well, I just want to keep that appetite out there growing for
Oh, we can't wait to hear that one. Okay. I think that form will spread, too. Okay, can you read some more?
Yeah, sure. Well, we're talking about political stuff. This is one of them called Market Report. Another down day. Read how I made $2 million between Christmas and Easter. First rule, lie a lot. Baron Rothschild gave the best advice. Buy when there's blood in the streets, but try to do it. If you have no money, money is the only important thing. That's how the boss gets you. If you have some money, there's 3,000 years of poems, music, art, not to mention food, Starbucks, and Cancun. For the old French, Versailles. For the old Romans, Capri and Pompeii, plus nature, the murmuring pines and the hemlocks, still plenty of it around the ex-rainforests, the former mountaintops, the kaput coral reefs. First rule, everything's cool if you have endless exponential growth, which means another nature down day. This is called Epistle to the Minnepolitans. Years ago, my friend Bob Watt wrote a poem in which he said, "We should take all the money from the rich and give it to the poor." And a guy at a reading said, "That's communism. And anyway, if you took all the money from the rich, the poor are so stupid that in a few years, the rich would have it all back again." And Watt said, "That's okay. We just take it away from them again." He was just putting into practice Jesus' advice to give all you have to the poor. Though I now think, since I have more money than I did then, that I wouldn't want to do this, and can quote Engels on his friend Marx, who said a man's first duty was to provide for himself and his family. Though this poem isn't about Marx, it's about Jesus, who also said, "Easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven," and about all those outraged Christians out there. One of the things, and that's always interested me in the poetry world in the United States, is how many people publish in tiny little magazines, and you will often find in the author's notes and other magazines this long list of tiny things that you've never heard of. And it seems to me that poets, like other people, should have a certain degree of modesty about what they've done and not claim that everything they've scribbled or suggest that everything they've scribbled is great works. This poem is about that. It's called D.H. Lawrence Update. It's from something that D.H. Lawrence had said too. "Truly happy people don't need to know what so-and-so ate for breakfast and don't need to tell others what they ate. Happy people don't need to say how happy they are. And in fact, when people you don't know tell you how happy they are, you know that they're lying. Happy people don't smile malevolently at the folly of others. Happy people don't exaggerate their accomplishments. Don't say in their bios things like, 'Poems in over 100 mags and published widely in Bulgaria.'" And that also, I think, is probably a comment on Facebook, too, for that matter.
The poetry of Ed Ochester. Thank you so much, Ed. That was great.
Thanks.
And stay tuned for Trump Penis, which are coming.
Coming in the next few months in Pittsburgh.
Okay. You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.